The following podcast is sponsored by Financial Sense Wealth Management. To learn more about our investment services, go to financialsense.com or give us a call at 888-486-3939.
Wall Street ended a choppy week Friday with a broad sell-off. Rising Treasury yields drove investors to unload tech stocks. Yields briefly edged up to their highest level since mid-July, ahead of a key Federal Reserve meeting next week, where investors will look for signs of any shift in the central bank's timeline for tapering bond purchases. Also weighing on investor sentiment, corporate tax hikes and the spread of the Delta variant. The Dow lost 0.5% Friday. The S&P and NASDAQ pulled back nearly 1%, with the S&P closing below a key technical level widely watched by traders. For the week as well, the indexes lost ground.
All across Europe, prices have climbed to new records. Natural gas shortages are particularly worrying. European gas stockpiles are now at their lowest levels in years, at a time when demand will jump during the cold winter months. And in the North Sea, winds have stopped blowing. Thousands of wind turbines there are producing drastically less energy. Conventional energy sources, like coal, are filling that gap. The sudden reversal away from wind back to fossil fuels illustrates the difficulty of Europe's green transition.
This is the Financial Sense News Hour. Now, here's the Financial Sense News Team.
2 weeks of consecutive losses as markets react to what could be the largest tax hike in history. There was mixed economic data this week as it looks like the economy is beginning to slow down. Wall Street economists have downgraded economic growth for both Q3 and Q4. We could be going from 6% to 2% economic growth. Hi, everyone. I'm Jim Poplava, and welcome to this week's Financial Sense News Hour. Up on deck, John Kosar joins me from Asbury Research. Some of John's key indicators are flashing caution. You'll want to hear why. And also later on, Rick Sharga from Realty Track, he'll join us to discuss today's real estate market. But first, let's get a rundown on this week's market-moving events with Ryan Poplava. Ryan?
Another down week for stocks in the U.S. The 50-day moving average on the S&P 500 has been a great entry spot in the past along this market trend, but things could be changing this time. This is the first time we've settled near the 50-day moving average for longer than a day, and given that stocks are in this minor correction or dip, it's time to focus on the fundamentals. In that regard, Goldman downgraded GDP for the third quarter from 5.25% to 3.5%, not just based on jobs and the coronavirus, but also in response to July's stagnation in manufacturing and trade inventory, as well as a drop in the seasonally adjusted annual rate of the car market in the country. So let's take a look at this week's data to see if it corroborates with the Goldman call. I know it's not glamorous to look at the fundamentals and just the data, but if we're experiencing a dip, it's important to know if the fundamentals support a buy the dip reaction or time to cut risk exposure. So let's dig in here. The CPI report for August was out on Tuesday and increased 0.3% month over month and was a smidge 0.1% for core, which excludes energy and food. That left the CPI report up 5.3% versus 5.4% year over year in July, and 4% versus 4.3% in July for the core. Instead of relief, investors took this as a bearish sign that economic activity is slowing, so stocks sold off Tuesday. Now let's take a look at the manufacturing, since we got a few data points here. Industrial production increased 0.4% in August, following a downwardly revised 0.8% increase in July. So yes, some deceleration there. But the increase in August also came at the same time as COVID Delta, increases in infections there, as well as the impact from Hurricane Ida and ongoing supply issues. So that's not too bad. The Empire State Manufacturing Survey, think New England region, increased to 34.3 in September from 18.3 in August. So nice bounce in activity here. And the Philadelphia Fed Index also increased in September to 30.7 from 19.4. So huge rally, huge rebound in manufacturing for those regions. Another great increase. Finally, business inventories increased 0.5% in July following a revised 0.9% increase in June. So, yep, deceleration there. So far, Goldman may be right. That activity has slowed in the third quarter, but it's definitely not ending on a bad note. Retail sales increased 0.7% month-to-month in August, following a decline of 1.8% in July, powered by non-store retail sales, which surged 5.3%, while motor vehicle and parts dealers, as well as electronics and appliances, were down. Finally, let's take a look at the University of Michigan Index of Consumer Sentiment, which increased to 71 from 70.3. In the report, consumers see high prices as a hindrance to purchases in homes, vehicles, and household durables. I think consumer sentiment will be key to watch as we continue to see high prices, and also the market's sort of agreement with the Fed that inflation is transitory given low bond yields and a deceleration in the CPI as of late. The market may think so, but do consumers agree? We'll get a bunch of housing data next week to learn more just what's going on there for that segment of the economy for August. To summarize here, I think Goldman was right to downgrade GDP, but I don't think there's enough evidence for the bears to celebrate over a contraction. And it appears that manufacturing is ramping up in September. We're of the opinion the stock dip in the past couple of weeks will be one we want to buy into, but we're waiting to see if there's enough sentiment to drive it yet still lower. In other news this week, the headlines have been mixed surrounding the $3.5 trillion infrastructure plan and U.S. debt ceiling. Axios on Friday reported President Biden failed to persuade Senator Joe Manchin to support the full size. There was also a Bloomberg survey that suggests the Fed won't announce a taper until November. They do meet next week, but based off of Powell's speech at Jackson Hole, nobody thinks they will be announcing a taper until later. There was also some news related to COVID, but it didn't really affect things much except for in travel, hotel, and airline stocks. American Express said they haven't seen corporations increase spending much on travel. There was another lockdown for a Chinese province. Early in the week, a report from The Lancet suggests that a group of international scientists said current evidence doesn't support the need for the general populace to get a booster shot. So healthcare stocks fell on that news, especially Moderna, Pfizer, etc. So to end the week here, negative press related to the $3.5 trillion infrastructure plan and the U.S. debt ceiling, downgrades in the semiconductor industry for Cree and Cirrus Logic, negative press related to third booster shots, and a consumer sentiment report that missed expectations were what pulled stocks down slightly on the week, while the all-important technical support of that 50-day moving average for the S&P 500 was being tested. But I'll leave more on that up to our technician this week with that interview up next.
Uranium stocks have seen an absolute explosion over the last month. And this week on FS Insider, we spoke with Yellow Bull Mart Wolbert. We talk about a large number of structural factors lining up for uranium stocks and nuclear power, including a potential game changer for the industry as a whole. Here's a clip of what he told listeners on this week's FS Insider podcast.
For the long term, there's a very clear bullish picture for nuclear power. Contrary to popular belief, nuclear is actually a growth industry. And I think that if you look at the best performing asset class 5 years from now, I think we'll look back on uranium as being one of the best, if not the very best performer of all of those.
To listen to this full 30-minute podcast where we discuss everything you need to know about what's happening both in nuclear power and in the uranium sector, go to financialsense.com and hit the subscribe button.
Financial Sense Wealth Management has been named as one of the top investment advisory firms in the U.S. by the Financial Times. Let us put our financial expertise to work for you. Call now at 888-486-3939 or email grow at financialsense.com. Advisory services offered through Financial Sense Advisors, Inc., a registered investment advisor. Securities offered through Financial Sense Securities, Inc., member FINRA SIPC. Both companies doing business as Financial Sense Wealth Management.
Well, stocks seem to be going sideways. What about the future? This is that time of the year when we normally see pullbacks in the market. Let's find out what's going on with John Kosar from Asbury Research. John, one of the first things I want to ask you is you have a protection model. Given this sideway action, what is that telling you about the markets right now?
Well, the correction protection model has been risk on since August the 25th. So even though we've had this sloppy week, like, you know, let's call it, and we're right back on the 50-day moving average again, it is still in a risk-on mode. Our other tactical tool, which is the Asbury 6, it's a little bit more sensitive. That has moved to a negative reading. And the Asbury 6 is more of an indicator than a model. And we equate it to when you go to the doctor's office and he always does those five or six things over and over again. You know, he takes your pulse, takes your blood pressure, usually takes a drop of blood, checks your heart and lungs. So that's kind of what the Asbury 6 is. And that has turned negative as of a couple of days ago. So you've got a divergence of sorts between our two tactical models.
You know, there seems to be a lot of divergences all over in this sector. Let's talk about the S&P itself. Up until recently, technology has been a leader most of the year. It's pulling back. What's your take with this constant rotation that we have seen in 2021?
It's like the leaders are throwing it back and forth like it's a hand grenade. You don't see any kind of consistent leadership. You've had small cap, you know, the Russell 2000 or IWM, if you're looking at the ETF, that has been underperforming pretty much for the whole year. And then you've had, up until recently, you've had mostly underperformance from February on in the both of the NASDAQs and also in the semiconductors and the SOX index. It's been an odd year in that way where the market breadth continues to deteriorate. The leaders aren't leading for very long. Like I said, they seem to be tossing the leadership around like they don't want it. And it's been an unusual year in that way. I don't recall seeing a year like this. And I've been doing this for 40 years. I'm sure there was one or two that I just don't remember. But this year seems to be driven by the dip, kind of Pavlovian, by the dip in the S&P 500. But when you look under the hood of the market, it's not too great.
No, I was looking at, I think there were two stocks, Google and I'm trying to think if it's Apple, that account for almost 20% of the S&P's gains this year. So you're looking at some of these stocks that, what is Apple now, 6.8% of the index? Some of these big stocks that have actually been leading it. So if you look at the S&P, it looks like it's gone up, but what is really driving it is a handful of stocks, it looks like.
I've been watching Apple like a hawk. I've been watching Microsoft, Amazon, because that's exactly right. There's a handful of, you know, Tesla's another one. There's a handful of very large cap, very influential stocks that have had a lot to do, you know, with the market's resilience this year. Apple is certainly one of them. Something I'm watching on Apple is, as the S&P 500 is testing its 50-day moving average, so is Apple. And interesting to me is that the daily relative performance of Apple versus the S&P 500 is starting to deteriorate quietly, but it's starting to deteriorate and it's starting to move into a strategic trend of relative underperformance. Strategic for us is one business quarter or 63 days. So on a 63-day basis, Apple is on the verge of underperforming the S&P 500. So that's another little nuance of the market that I'm paying a lot of attention to now, because if that happens over the next couple of days and you see Apple starting to underperform, well, we've just lost another, it's kind of like a dog sled, but instead of 20 dogs pulling it, there's like four. And if you know, we lose Apple, that's losing one of those dogs.
Yeah, and even take a looking at Google, which has kind of been flat here in some of the other stocks. What about Amazon?
I'm looking at the chart of Amazon right now. Amazon peaked in September of last year. And since then, it's been moving sideways. It had a kind of ill-fated attempt to make some new highs during July. And now we're right back in this very tight range from about 3,500 going down to about 2,850. And in the meantime, it's been quietly underperforming the S&P 500. So yeah, that's just another one of those stocks that hasn't really participated in this. It's actually been more of an anchor than it has been a help.
You know, another interesting phenomenon that I find right now in the markets, and a lot of this relates to the Fed, But we've got 10-year treasuries roughly in the 1.3% range, and they're reporting inflation of 5%. At least, John, in my 40-year career in the business, normally if you would have had inflation at 5% in the past, we would have probably seen higher interest rates. But that's kind of hard when you have the Fed, you know, basically buying $120 billion a month. What's your take on interest rates and gold here?
We had been long gold. Let's get over to gold here first. You know, we use GLD for our gold proxy, and I pay a lot of attention to when I'm looking at a ETF like GLD, you know, one of the major commodities that I'll follow through an ETF, I pay a lot of attention to the asset flows that are going into GLD, you know, or UNG now is, you know, Nat Gas has been flying, you know, we can talk about that one a little bit if you like. But we actually were long GLD earlier in the year from March, April, and we got rid of it right around the middle of June because it started to underperform the S&P 500, you know, number one. And for me, there's no reason to be in gold if it's underperforming the stock market. Why would you be in gold? Just be in the stock market and, you know, own a basket of 500 stocks, the S&P 500, instead of kind of being held hostage to the whims of what one commodity might do. So we've been out of that one because it's underperforming. It's been underperforming the S&P since then. And secondly, total net assets invested in GLD started to contract on a monthly or a 21-day basis. 21 days is our tactical time period. So I actually just put a report out about a week ago, kind of telling our clients, you know, don't take the bait on gold. Gold got back up above the 200-day moving average, GLD did, about a week and a half ago. And we just put out a little short little piece that said, don't take the bait, because the asset flows had not come in to support that little bounce in gold that we've had from the August lows. So that appears to me that it's obviously, it's having a terrible day today. It's gapped down. But until we see some relative outperformance there and or some asset flows, you know, I've been out of there since the middle of June.
So given this rotation, constant rotation that we're seeing, the lack of leadership that we're seeing, is this just a period of digestion that you normally see in a bull market where you see, if you take a look at where stocks have been from March of last year, you know, it's almost like they've been going straight up. So what's your overall assessment of what you feel is going on here?
What I think has happened is, I mean, obviously the Fed being so involved here is a major, if not, you know, the major contributing factor to the market going up so much so fast. I think at a peak, it's up like 107% from the March lows of last year. It's just a ridiculous amount. And in the meantime, you know, you look at, you know, market breadth. It's been deteriorating since the beginning of the year. The leadership has been spotty. If you look at the sectors, the 11 sectors of the S&P, according to the sector spiders, there's only a few of those that are outperforming the S&P 500. What I think is going on is that the S&P is kind of acting, as odd as this may sound, it's almost acting independently from the rest of the market. I think people have been trained Pavlovian style, that when the S&P gets down to the 50-day moving average, people buy SPY. And then, you know, the originator has to go out and buy all the constituent stocks and SPY. But in the meantime, the individual parts of the market have not been performing well. So I almost think you've got the S&P 500 acting one way, but underneath the hood of the market, you see all this weakness. It's an odd occurrence. I don't remember seeing it happen before. But I think in some ways, the broad market S&P 500 is almost acting independently of the rest of the market.
The distortion that you get when you have a handful of large cap stocks that are driving returns, you know, people think of the S&P 500 stocks. What they don't understand is the market weight of how a handful of stocks, whether we're talking about Google, Tesla, Apple, Amazon, can drive the returns of the market, and it's misleading. You're thinking, oh, S&P's up, but you're talking about a handful of stocks that's doing the heavy lifting.
Yeah, that's really what's been going on here. I'm looking at the top 12 stocks here as we talk. And as I said, from a relative performance basis, Apple really needs to firm up here, or it's going to start underperforming the S&P on a quarterly basis. You know, Microsoft is obviously doing a lot of the work here, as, you know, so has Google, Amazon, we talked about flat. You're starting to lose some relative performance out of Facebook. Of the top 10 stocks, five or six of them are doing really well. You know, Berkshire Hathaway is underperforming. You know, JP Morgan has been flat as a pancake on a relative basis since, you know, July. Visa underperforming, J&J underperforming, Walmart underperforming. So, you know, and you could see this in the sector space. You could see this in the industry group space. There's just not a lot of places in the market that are outperforming the S&P 500. I don't know that I've ever seen it this thin before.
So when you're in this kind of situation, what do? Do you stay invested given what your model, your risk on is still risk on? It's been that way since August. Do you see that reversing? Or I guess, what would you have to see before you would tell me, hey, it's time to go to the sidelines here?
Yeah, that's a great question. And when the Asbury 6, which again is our daily trip to the doctor's office for the market, so to speak, we update that every day. When that starts to turn negative or turn red, as it is now, that's usually our clients' cue to get ready to possibly start, you know, taking some equity exposure out of the market. You know, take a look at what you own, ETF stocks, whatever they may be, indexes, and start to find those that are underperforming or those that have broken a big support level. It's obvious, and start to have a plan in place as to when you wake up one morning and everything is down and everybody's running around like a chicken with their head cut off. You know, you've already kind of got a quarter of those stocks, maybe those holdings that, you know, you've already looked at, so you kind of know what to do. But what's necessary in order to trigger us to, you know, for this to become actionable, let's say, is our CPM model, you know, the correction protection model, has to go to risk off. And we have to break what we define as the primary tactical support level in the S&P 500. And right now, it's 44.34 right now. That's the 50-day moving average. I mean, the market's tested it 9 times since January 29th. I don't know that I've ever seen that before. Have it come down into that level. It was down to this morning, you know, and the bell rang, you know, Pavlov's dog, and everybody came in and, you know, the market's trying to come back. It was down 35 earlier. It's down 20 now. But those two things have to happen. The CPM, that has to turn the risk off, and we have to break that, you know, tactical support level, which I think, you know, right now is obviously the 50-day moving average. The strength of the CPM, by the way, it can't see the future, just like nobody can see the future. It's actually comprised of several different indicators that I have built in my career, and we backtested them and found that they work very well together as sort of a trio. And the strength of it is over the past 10 years, it stayed very close to the S&P 500 in terms of performance. But the beta on CPM is 0.41 versus 1.0 beta, of course, for the S&P 500. So the magic, if there is any, in CPM is the risk-adjusted returns are outstanding. So that's why this model is important to us, not that it's an aggressive model or is making calls on the future or what the Fed might do, but rather really tamping down the volatility. Most of our clients are older and wealthier and are not as anxious to take a lot of risk. A lot of them are afraid to be in the stock market because of what can happen to you because of the volatility. So we built a model basically to tamp that down.
Yeah, I'm just looking at the S&P and the number of times it's touched the 50-day moving average, and you can just see by the dip right there. As soon as it touches it, boom, it bounces. And it's done that, as you mentioned, almost 9 times, and we're almost there right now.
Yeah, this is the 9th time, And, you know, this instance is the ninth time. And we've been, if you look at a daily chart, you know, you could argue that it was tested on the 13th, 14th, 15th, and today's the 16th. So, you know, the market so sees it, it's almost comical. I mean, it's just really leaning on it hard. You know, and most of the daily volume in the stock market comes from, you know, computer trading, algorithmic trading. I think a lot of this, you know, phenomenon really has to do with where the volume's coming from.
Mm. So I know you follow money flows into sectors and spaces. Anything really stand out to you right now?
Well, we have another model. It's called the SEAF model, S-E-A-F. It stands for Sector ETF Asset Flows. And what we did was we built a model that looks at the 11 sector spiders in the S&P 500 as if, you know, they are, you know, the sector universe, you know, which they're supposed to be. You know, they're supposed to represent the S&P 500 or certainly very close to it. And then we watch the asset flows, percentage change in asset flows in and out of each sector on a trading basis, which is 5 days for us, a tactical basis, which is 21 days for us, and a strategic basis, which is 63 days for us. And we watch the biggest percentage of assets in and the biggest percentage of assets out for each of those three time periods. And it helps us to find trends in asset flows, you know, rather than just looking at the relative performance of XLE versus SPY. This is actually watching those flows kind of move around the board, and it helps us to find trends in asset flows. Right now, the model has been overweight technology since June 17th, and XLK is up 10.7%. And it's outperformed SPY by 3.3. And the other one that we've been overweight is healthcare. Healthcare since July 6th, that's up 4.1%. And it's outperformed SPY by about 1%, just exactly 1%. But otherwise, the asset flow movement, according to the model, has shown the same thing that we're kind of seeing in the bigger market. You're seeing money go into one or two sectors. It'll stay there for a week or two, and it'll come right back out again and go somewhere else. The only two staples, so to speak, I don't mean consumer staples, but the only two that have had any longevity there, again, since June and July, have been the tech and the healthcare sectors.
Yeah, it's amazing to see this rotation. Well, listen, John, as we close, if our listeners would like to follow the work that you do at Asbury, how can they do so?
The best thing to do is to go to the website. It's asburyresearch.com and go to the contact page. And if you and there's a little place there where you can write a note to us. Just put financial sense 20% off. And what we'll do through the end of September is we'll give anybody who's interested in us and who's tracked us on your show to sign up for either a 3 or a 12 month subscription to Asbury Research for 20% off the regular price. Or if all you want is some more information about us, you can just jot, you know, down, please send us more info and we can do that as well. But that's the best way to get a hold of us.
All right. Well, listen, John, as always, it's a pleasure speaking with you. Stay safe, and we'll be talking to you again.
Stagflation is here. So says Peter Bookvar, the widely read strategist at The Book Report, who discussed with FS Insider this week what he believes is the underlying trend for inflation, the economy, and how he is investing in today's markets. Here's a clip of what he told listeners this week on FS Insider.
Even if inflation moderates, and easily could, if it remains elevated relative to where it was pre-COVID, that in turn is a problem. The world is not set up to absorb a sustainable period of even 3 to 4% inflation.
If you want to listen to this full interview, go to financialsense.com and click the subscribe button.
Are you getting closer to retirement? Do you worry about what retirement will look like? Financial Sense Wealth Management can help put your mind at ease. Our advisors can help customize an individual retirement plan that fits your needs and helps you get on the right track to achieving your retirement goals. We'll show you how to get the most out of your Social Security benefits, make the right decisions on Medicare, reduce taxes, and increase your return on investments so you can relax and enjoy your retirement years. Don't leave your retirement up to chance. Contact Financial Sense Wealth Management today at 888-486-3939 or email us at grow@financialsense.com.
Well, everybody's been excited about what's happened to the stock market over the last 2 years, but there's another market that is very strong that's going up and people are making money. I'm talking about real estate. Joining us on the program is Rick Sharga. He's Executive Vice President of Realty Track. Before we get to real estate prices and what's going on, I want to get your take on foreclosures now that the moratorium on rent forbearance has been lifted. Do you see that bringing foreclosures to the market? Or how will this impact the real estate market for, let's say, landowners?
Yeah, Jim, it's good to talk to you. And there's a lot going on in the market right now. Because your listeners might be a little bit confused by all the government programs, let's take a quick step back just to identify what's been going on and what's been lifted recently. There were three separate programs. There was a CDC's eviction ban, which applied to renters, which we can talk about. There was a government ban on foreclosures, which was recently lifted. That ended July 31st. And there's also a mortgage forbearance program that was part of the CARES Act. And that gave homeowners whose income was affected by COVID a 6-month forbearance period where they didn't have to pay their mortgages with an optional 6-month extension. And that program was eventually extended by another 6 months. So we actually have some homeowners who were in that program in March of 2020 when the program started, who will finally be exiting this fall. So they've been in the program for 18 months. So all these things are coming to an end more or less at the same time. There's about 1.6 million people left in the mortgage forbearance program. About half of them are scheduled to roll out over the last few months of this year. And the other half will gradually leave the program over the first half of 2022. The good news when it comes to the housing market is that we don't expect a lot of those borrowers to wind up in foreclosure. There have been over 8 million people in the program already since it started. And as I said, we're down to about 1.6 million now. That means the other 6.4 million have already exited the program. And as they've exited the program, they've done so successfully. One of the indicators for that, Jim, is that delinquency rates on mortgages have come down for 9 consecutive months. So if we had 6.5 million people in forbearance and they exited and were having trouble making mortgage payments, we would have seen those delinquency numbers go up rather than go down. But there are still some areas of vulnerability. FHA borrowers are one of those areas. Those borrowers tend to have less equity. They tend to have higher debt, lower cash reserves. When those borrowers find themselves in financial trouble, they're going to have a little bit harder time getting out of it. So markets like San Bernardino and Riverside in California, San Antonio, Houston, Dallas in Texas, Orlando and Tampa in Florida, Philadelphia, Chicago, handful of other markets around the country that have a high density number of FHA borrowers who are delinquent. Those could be areas where you have some local market impact on housing as those borrowers have a hard time avoiding foreclosure.
Well, the one thing that kind of strikes me during this whole forbearance, Rick, was there any forbearance for landowners? In other words, if I cannot evict my tenant because he's not paying rent, I still owe the government property taxes and I still owe the bank a mortgage payment. Was there forbearance for the landowners?
That is a great question, and it's something I wish the government had asked early on in the process. There were some very modest forbearance programs that were offered to small landlords. And these were landlords who would finance their purchases through Fannie or Freddie backed loans. And they were basically given about a 3-month forbearance window. Now, you compare that to the fact that there's been an eviction ban on their tenants for the better part of 2 years, and you can see that the math doesn't work terribly well. We've actually issued 2 reports at Realty Track where we've taken a look on a county-by-county basis across the country and tried to determine which markets might be the most vulnerable to foreclosures, because what nobody seems to recognize is that over 90% of the single family rental units that are out there in the market, some 19 million of them, are owned by mom and pop investors. These are not BlackRock and Blackstone and huge institutional investment companies. These are your neighbors who own two or three properties and either count on those properties for their retirement income, or to the point you made earlier, Jim, the income they collect from their tenants is what they use to pay down their own mortgages, pay their property taxes, and so forth and so on. And those landlords have been hung out to dry. The good news, and this is another good news, bad news, Jim, the good news is that the government has set aside $45 billion to be available for the purpose of paying tenants back rent. And that would cover a huge, huge percentage of the rent that's owed by tenants who haven't been able to make their payments or have chosen not to make their payments. The problem is that less than 10% of that's been distributed. So there's over $40 billion of funding from the federal government sitting there at the state level waiting to be distributed. And I'm afraid that we're going to have landlords who have to file bankruptcy, lose a property to foreclosure, or sell it at a distressed price while they're waiting for these funds to be distributed.
Let's move to another topic. One of the things that we've seen with COVID, a lot of businesses were shut down or working remotely, my own business included. And what we've seen, there was an article in the Wall Street Journal yesterday talking about, like, in Silicon Valley, a lot of the tech companies are not going back to work and they're allowing their employees to work remotely permanently in many cases. They were talking about this one couple that moved to Boise, Idaho, where they could afford to live. The housing was a lot cheaper. Let's talk about that impact, because COVID has certainly changed the real estate market.
COVID has accelerated a trend we were already seeing in the real estate market. And I'll circle right back to the tech idea you talked about. But prior to the pandemic, we were already starting to see millennial couples who were renting urban properties move out and become suburban homeowners. The pandemic and the lockdowns really, really accelerated that trend significantly. Apparently, it wasn't quite as much fun to be quarantined in a 700 square foot apartment with a toddler as most couples thought it might be. So they moved out to the suburbs looking for more space in their homes for a home office or to homeschool kids, and more space between neighbors because there was a perceived health benefit. And these folks didn't just move right across the border to the suburbs. In a lot of cases, they moved out to the distant suburbs or even rural areas because they don't have to worry about that commute as they're working from home either all the time or most of the time. If you really want to see that trend at its most extreme, you look to California, you look to Silicon Valley, some other areas in coastal California, where workers are able to take the cash that they get from selling their California property and buy a home for cash in a more expensive or less expensive market, a more affordable market. Because of that, we've seen, you know, the influx of people going to cities like Boise, Salt Lake City, some other secondary and tertiary markets just explode over the last year. Lake Tahoe on the Nevada side of the border has exploded. Dallas cities, Florida cities. But Boise is a great example, Jim, because you and I were talking about it before the broadcast today. Year-over-year price increases on existing home sales, 45%, which is just astronomical. It's unheard of. So I do think you're going to see that trend continue for a bit. Not every industry is going to be able to let its employees work from home, certainly not at those distances. But we've heard people like Mark Zuckerberg, the founder of Facebook, talk about, you know, rethinking the need to have everybody centrally located in a Silicon Valley facility that costs them millions and millions of dollars a year to operate, when they actually might benefit from having satellite offices or work from home offices across the country, and ultimately be able to pay some of those employees more affordable local wages.
You know, the thing that really strikes me, being a California resident, things have always been more expensive in California. But Rick, I think the median price home in California is over $800,000, and our definition of a millionaire here is a homeowner. How long can this continue? I mean, at some point, even with low interest rates, when you have housing prices going up 10, 15, 20% a year, how long can this continue where people just, even with low interest rates, they won't be able to afford a mortgage payment.
I was speaking at a conference recently, and I mentioned the same statistic you just did, that the median price of a home in California, this is back in June, by the way, was $800,000. And what that meant was that neither of my kids would ever be able to afford a home here. And I was only half joking. If I were moving into the state today, as I did 20 years ago, I'm not sure I'd be able to buy a home. And I make a pretty decent living. There's a couple things to factor in here. One is that there's virtually nothing available for entry-level buyers. So one of the reasons that the median home price is as high as it is due to what I call product mix. If the first level home that's available is a move-up home, a mid-priced home, that automatically kind of moves your median value up a little bit. So one of the factors we're dealing with here is that what's usually an entry-level price property simply doesn't exist in California at the moment. That's not good news for first-time home buyers, but it does explain a little bit of the price inflation. The second thing to keep in mind is that a lot of people buying these houses are trading in their current house to buy the new one. Almost all of this is move-up buyers, not first-time buyers. And they've generated a ton of equity. So they're making huge down payments on these properties, which keeps their monthly payments relatively affordable. And the third thing that contributes to this is we're still dealing with historically low interest rates. In many states today, not California, but many states today, even with home prices being up 15, 16, 17% year over year, the monthly mortgage payment has gone down. And that's because somebody's been able to buy a house with a 2.5, 2.75% mortgage, where their old house had a 4 or 4.5% mortgage. All of that has an end game. At some point, we hit an affordability wall. And I think we've begun to see that in California. Some of the higher priced markets, we've actually seen price corrections beginning. And in other markets, we've seen home price appreciation slow way down. So hopefully we'll start to see the builders deliver more product. That should open up some things at the low end and stop some of these bidding wars. The other thing that could bring this home price appreciation to a screeching halt is if we see interest rates go up and if the inflationary fears we're hearing about come true and when inflation gets stuck around 5% or worse, you'll see mortgage rates go up as well. And that will put a dramatic halt to home price increases.
You know, one of the things that I have seen, I have a client who's a custom home builder, and he says as a result of COVID, the building of custom homes now, people want like two offices because husband and wife may work at home. They want things like gyms and movie theaters, the places you weren't allowed to go to during the shutdown. Are you seeing this trend nationally, or is this just something here with California, or are you seeing it around the country?
Absolutely, we're seeing demands for bigger properties. And that's one of the reasons you're seeing a lot of both home building and home buying in further suburbs and in you know rural or semi-rural areas where the land is cheaper and it's more affordable to build that bigger property. You know, there's some interesting you know side notes to that too. If you're working from home, you're gonna need high speed bandwidth. If you're moving to a rural area, that may not be available. So you peel one layer of the onion away and you find another one that gets confusing. Your friend who does custom building might be encountering another trend we're seeing that's COVID related, Jim. We've seen builders actively slowing down the sale of new homes because they simply can't get materials and the goods they need to finish construction of the properties, or prices have escalated so rapidly because of supply chain disruption that they don't want to enter into a binding contract and they'll wind up paying two or three times more for materials. So, windows are on back order for 6 months. Appliances sometimes are unavailable for months on end. So the builders have actually stopped writing contracts on properties that aren't fully completed, and that's slowing down new home sales. So it's a really, really interesting dynamic that we're seeing in the housing market right now in many, many ways.
You know, it's interesting because I was going to develop my upper acre and I can't get a landscape contractor because they're all booked. And the other thing my builder client has told me, it's taking longer because not only is there a shortage of labor, but as you mentioned, some of the material costs. I have one client who basically has gone to cost plus because, you know, you do a bid on a job and it's X amount of dollars when you start, but 9 months later with material cost, you know, your profits could be eaten away just by inflation.
Absolutely. And it's, you know, inflation is one thing, but as the supply chain gets disrupted, it becomes a supply and demand issue. And people are actually bidding up prices on raw materials. It's insane. So we started the year off in January. If you looked at new home sales and extrapolated for the balance of the year, it looked like we might have sold 1 million new homes across the country this year. And a lot of that, again, is COVID related because people want certain things in their properties that aren't necessarily available in existing homes. But we've seen those numbers just contract dramatically over the last few months. And a lot of it is because of the issues, the headwinds builders are facing in being able to build these properties. It's probably, and that's a problem because we're probably somewhere between 3 and 4 million homes in deficit compared to what we need for demand. And the biggest group of millennials, who are the biggest generation in U.S. history, are all rapidly approaching prime age for becoming a first-time home buyer. So you have this demand with lackluster building for the last decade that's catching up with us at exactly the same time. We're going to have an unprecedented number of people entering the market. And that's really what's been driving all the prices up.
You know, it was interesting, Rick. About 2 years ago, I went up to Reno checking out property up there. And we were looking at a big development by Toll Brothers. I think they had like 6 or 7 projects going at the same time, and they basically could sell everything they were building. With this demand that's coming with the millennials, why have home builders not put more product out there? Is it a matter of finding enough labor? Because that's one of the problems here with restaurants and a lot of small businesses. You can't find workers. It's a worker shortage. So what is holding back builders from pumping out more product?
Well, we talked about two of the things, and you just mentioned a key one. Skilled labor is almost impossible for the builders to find. And partly it's their own fault. They pretty much shut down during the Great Recession and have only very slowly started working their way back toward any kind of measurable volume. And all the people that were trained in the, you know, the construction arts, if you will, went on and did other things and aren't necessarily anxious to come back. We also have a market that was about somewhere between 35 and 40% immigrant labor. And a lot of it was day laborers or laborers here on temporary work visas. And that pipeline has kind of dried up a bit. Both during the prior administration and during the pandemic, so it's been really hard to find labor. I suspect that now that the enhanced federal unemployment benefits have expired this month, we'll start to see labor become a little bit more available, both in the service industries and construction. But the other things that have been headwinds for the builders, we're now dealing with supply issues. There's a lack of land availability. And in many markets, and this is particularly true in California, zoning has become so restrictive that it's very difficult for builders to find anything to build on. Or even if they secure a parcel, it might take them 2 years to get through all the regulatory hurdles they need to get through in order to start building. And because of that and the delays, it's sometimes difficult for them to get capital because their investors don't necessarily want to wait 2 to 3 years to start realizing a return on their investment. So builders are really in a tough spot right now.
Yeah, where I live, it could take anywhere from 14 to 18 months to get a building permit.
And according to Fannie Mae, it costs a builder on average across the country $80,000 before they break ground. In California, it's $100,000. And that doesn't take into account the extra money that is now needed to make sure that every new home in the state comes with its own solar panel or solar energy system, which was a law put in place a little over a year ago. So it's tough sledding for the builders. The areas where there's the most need, they have the most restrictive zoning and aren't able to even get in there and begin building. So it's tough. And by the way, we're seeing the same thing on the multifamily market. That's another market where we have historically low vacancy rates. We've seen rental prices go up almost 12% year over year nationally, and the builders just can't find land to build on.
So, Rick, as we close here, what would you tell potential real estate buyers? Let's take a first-time buyer and another buyer that's looking to trade up.
So I think the caveat here is if you're looking for a home to live in, don't think of it first as an investment. Think of it first as where you're going to live, and understand that there's a certain amount of money that you're going to pay for your domicile, whatever it is, whether it's a rental property or a home you're going to own. And over time, for most people, being a homeowner is the better financial choice. That's not universally true, but over time for most people, it generally is. So if you have a time horizon that extends out more than a few years, not a bad time to buy a home, even at today's prices, even with the knowledge that it's likely we'll see a correction in some markets. You may lose temporarily 3, 4, 5, maybe even 10% of the value of the property. But over time, historically, home values have gone up. The real estate investors I'm more concerned with right now, candidly, are the people that are looking to fix and flip. And for them, market timing and market pricing is a little bit more critical. You could wind up buying at the top of the market and in a market where the supplies you need to fix up a property are likely to go up rather than go down. So that's an area I'd urge some caution on. But if you're looking for a home to own and you're planning to be there for the foreseeable future, probably not as scary a time as you might expect. And oh, by the way, probably a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to lock in some of the lowest mortgage rates in history.
All right. Well, listen, Rick, as we close, if our listeners would like to follow the work that you guys do at Realty Track, tell them about it and how they can find you.
Yeah, I mean, Realty Track, we publish a blog. There are new articles going up every week. It's at realtytrack.com, realtytrac.com. You can sign up for our free monthly email newsletter where we send out 6 or 7 articles and keep people up to speed on what's going on in the real estate investing market. You can follow me also on Twitter or LinkedIn. Rick Sharga is my Twitter handle, and I'm happy to connect with any of your listeners on LinkedIn as well, Jim.
All right. Well, listen, Rick, as always, a pleasure having you on the program. Please come back again.
Always a pleasure to talk to you, Jim, and look forward to doing it again soon.
Chris Maplava is the Chief Investment Officer for Financial Sense Wealth Management. And Chris, I want to discuss some of the items that you touched upon in this week's weekly investment video, which we posted on our website, as well as on YouTube, looking at COVID, inflation, your overall market outlook, and a number of key items. Let's start with the first point that you addressed, which is the COVID data. It looks like we have seen a peak now, as we've been talking about over the last month or so, in the 7-day average for global COVID cases. So what's your outlook there?
Yeah, if you look at the US, it's, I think, pretty safe to say we have seen a peak. The UK, you know, they did have a peak in July and they saw a resurgence, but it looks like now they've had a secondary peak as well as their cases have been rolling over. And in terms of Europe, looking at the big countries, France, Italy, Germany, Spain, their cases more or less peaked around July, August, and they've been having a slow decline since. Japan, that was the one that just exploded this summer with cases. I think more than double, almost 2.5 times their prior peak this winter. So they had a real run with COVID cases this summer. They've clearly peaked. So a lot of the developed world has seen a peak in their COVID cases. The Delta wave kind of came in, swept through, and appears to be slowing down.
Well, that's certainly a good thing. And let's hope that we continue to see that, not just for the developed world, but for emerging markets, developing world as well. I just got off the phone with Lorianne LaRocco from CNBC, and she was talking about what we're seeing in Vietnam. And, you know, I mean, there's millions of people there that have been on lockdown now for 4 months. And Vietnam is a major exporter for a large number of different goods. And you can't leave your house for even food. So the police have to deliver the food there. And she says it's just an absolute tragedy, people being locked up for so long. But of course, this is having implications for inflation, delivery times, and ongoing disruptions that we're seeing. So what are some of the downstream impacts you're now looking at with this peak in terms of either economic or market impacts?
Well, I think that, as I mentioned, Japan saw the largest spike in cases relative to their initial spike this winter or this past winter. And with their dramatic decline, I've noticed that Japanese bond yields, which peaked earlier this spring, they've been declining ever since. But what I noticed this month is that their Japanese bond yields are starting to move up again. I'm also noticing the same with break-even inflation rates in Japan. Also, that is being associated with a breakout in the Japanese stock market. So it appears the economic data is starting to strengthen in Japan, as well as the financial market data to kind of reflect that peak in COVID cases. And in terms of Europe, one of the things that was pretty interesting in Europe, even with the pickup in COVID cases this summer, you know, break-even inflation rates in Europe continue to rise. Right now, the 10-year break-even euro inflation rate is about 1.84%. Now, I know that may not seem very high. I mean, it's below 2%, but that's the highest reading in their break-even inflation rate since roughly 2014. So we're hitting a 7-year high in inflation expectations in Europe. Likewise, German bund yields are starting to rally just like Japan's are. So we are seeing a bit of a kind of a reflation trade going on in Europe, in Japan, associated with peaks in COVID cases. Here in the U.S., we have, it looks like, seen a peak in COVID cases, but I wouldn't say we're seeing similar trends there. Break-even inflation rates here in the U.S. aren't moving up. Interest rates in the U.S. really haven't moved up meaningful either. We have seen the stock market continuing to rally, but that's something you and I will discuss a little bit later in the show. I think that's basically being pushed by only a handful of members. But outside of that, we're really not seeing a lot of confirmation in terms of the reflation trade with the peak in COVID cases here in the U.S.
So when it comes to Europe, where we have now seen a peak, like you said, we've seen a peak generally in the developed world. Europe is part of that, U.S. as well. Still haven't quite seen that in a number of emerging markets. But in those places where we have seen a peak, it does appear that break-even inflation rates are climbing, with the exception of the U.S. so far right now. And as you have heard, Chris, and as many of our listeners have probably now seen the news, where we're seeing skyrocketing energy and electricity prices in Europe, which is definitely contributing to the rise in break-even inflation. Before we delve into that a little bit more, I just want to define what that is. Break-even inflation is a market-based measure of inflation. So the official numbers, if you're talking about the CPI, that's lagged. That typically comes in about a month or sometimes 2 months, and then there's revision. So break-even inflation is what a lot of strategists look at in terms of getting a real-time pulse of what's taking place on the inflationary front.
That's correct. You know, in terms of when you think about nominal growth is really real growth plus the rate of inflation to get a nominal growth rate. And it's similar to interest rates. You can have nominal yields, which are basically comprised of the real yield plus the inflation component. And so essentially, sometimes the real yields can move differently from inflation expectations or the inflation component, where even with economic growth. So you can have really high economic growth rates, but the bulk of that could be inflationary, basically price increases versus a real growth in economic activity. So that's why it's pretty helpful to understand what's going on with inflation trends and decomposing the growth rate or decomposing interest rates into the various components to see really what's driving trends in growth and in interest rates.
Well, Chris, as you noted, with this peak in global COVID cases, we're seeing break-even inflation rates rise both in Europe and Japan currently. However, we're not seeing that in the U.S. So do you mind delving into what you're seeing here in the U.S. when it comes to the break-even inflation story and some of the other things you're looking at?
Absolutely. You know, when I'm looking at the U.S., looking at 5-year break-evens on the U.S., those peaked in the summer, roughly around May, and we're slightly off of those levels. So we're not hitting new highs. And if you look as far back as March, we've more or less gone sideways ever since March. Another kind of measure I take a look at is the copper-gold ratio. You know, copper is kind of seen as a reflationary, economic, you know, sensitive metal. Gold typically does well in deflationary, disinflationary environments where interest rates are collapsing, driving real interest rates lower. And looking at the copper-gold ratio, that too really hasn't gone anywhere since, I would say, March as well. So there's a real lack of trends in terms of financial and economic markets here in the U.S. When you look at the S&P, it's really dominated heavily by the big tech giants. But when you look at other indices that are more representative of the overall stock market, A good example of that is the Value Line Geometric Index. It comprises 1,700 stocks of the most widely followed institutionally held companies, and it's equal weighted. That index has essentially gone nowhere since March as well. It's as if, you know, a lot of the reflationary stocks and economically sensitive stocks took off in the first quarter and then just stopped climbing from that point. When you look at the dollar, more or less the dollar has been range bound for the bulk of the year. And while we did see a jump in interest rates here in the U.S. and then a subsequent decline, when you look at where they are right now, they're really no different than where they were in February. So, you know, more or less interest rates have kind of made zero progress. On the currency front, the dollar's made no progress. And in terms of the stock market, the bulk of stocks have not done well since the spring. And when you kind of go a little bit deeper into the market, you can kind of see why that is. So an example of that and kind of what I'm getting at is I wanted to see what happened when the Fed met in June and basically raised interest rates on overnight reserves. We saw the Fed's repo facility surge to the point where now we've got over $1.1 trillion that's come out of the financial system into the Fed's repo facility. And since we had that liquidity drain, while we've seen the market go up, it's really, again, being pushed by tech. So when you look at, you know, when the Fed met, so let's say June 15th to September 15th, a three-month period, large cap stocks measured by the S&P are up 5.88%. So let's just call it 5.9. Mid-cap stocks are down 0.5%. Small cap stocks are down almost 4%. Emerging markets down almost 4%. Bank stocks down 5. Energy stocks down 10. So we're talking a huge performance difference. You know, whether you're looking at capitalization or you're looking at sectors or geographically, it really is just a handful of pockets in the market that are doing well. When you look at tech, the sector as a whole, it's up 11% in a three-month period. Healthcare's done well. That's up about 7. But when you look at industrial stocks, down 1%, the Dow transports down, material stocks down, it's really, really isolated. And to really kind of put the nail in the coffin on this, when you look at the S&P's return through today, and we're speaking on the 17th, through yesterday, the S&P's total return, so that's dividends plus appreciation, it's looking at roughly around a 20% return. And of that return, two companies make up 20% of that entire return. So Microsoft alone has added 2 of that 20 percentage points. When you look at Google, Google's around 2.09 percentage points of that 20% return. So when you back out Microsoft and Google, you're shaving 4 percentage points off the market's return. That's two companies. When you want to throw in a couple others like Facebook, Apple, Nvidia, you're almost getting to where literally less than 10 companies explain half of the entire stock market's return. And beneath the surface, the market's a lot weaker than what you're seeing. For example, when you're looking at the Russell 2000, 44% of those small cap stocks are in bear markets right now, meaning they're down more than 20% from their highs. And when you look at other areas like mid-cap stocks, 28% of the S&P 400 are in bear markets. And when you look at the large cap, again, the strength is in large caps. Only 13% of the S&P is in a bear market right now. But when you look at the market as a whole, it's definitely a lot weaker when you're going from, you know, 28% in bear markets and mid-caps up to 44% of small-cap stocks in bear markets right now. The market is clearly a lot weaker than what would be seen just by looking at the stock market, essentially the large cap stocks.
Right. Yeah. And as we discussed earlier on the show today, if you look at the S&P 500, it's basically just right on its 50-day moving average. And if you look over the past year, every time it's hit that 50-day, it's either gone briefly under or has hit that and has staged a strong rally. So it's going to be interesting to see if whether or not we're going to be able to hold this current level, especially in the seasonally weak month of September, as we've been discussing as well, along with, as you noted with us 2 weeks ago, a peak in global liquidity.
Returns are muted, but still roughly positive as long as global liquidity is rising. But when you see both of them pull in and cool off, that's typically where we see most of the corrections in the market. So I'll have to update that measure, but last I looked, U.S. liquidity had clearly peaked, and we were seeing a stalling in global liquidity. But I do think the S&P is really overdue for a correction, or at least some kind of a healthy pullback. When you look at the market this year, the worst decline we saw was back in around, I think it was early March, at a roughly 4%. You know, outside of that, declines are being held to less than 3% decline. So it really has been a straight up affair, a real lack of volatility. But again, beneath the surface, we are seeing a lot more weakness in the market than would appear at, you know, on the surface.
And as we've discussed with you, with other guests, and you as well on the show, you know, leading economic indicators appear to be pointing towards a deceleration or slowdown for most of 2022, and perhaps higher than average inflation levels, which is basically our base case, is that we are going to see inflation remain on the persistent side, as you've noted on our show many times. So a number of different things that I think we all need to be aware of, especially as we head into holiday shopping season, which tends to be a good time for most businesses and retail. However, as we all know, we're still looking at supply shortages of goods. Inventory levels are not able to get recouped prior to this time, longer delivery times, higher prices. So it's going to be really interesting to see how that shakes out over the next few months. Chris, always a pleasure to speak with you on our show, and we look forward to having you on in another 2 weeks. That concludes our weekend edition of the Financial Sense NewsHour. To speak with our financial planning and wealth management team, give us a call at 888-486-3939 or go to financialsense.com and click where it says Contact Us. If you aren't already a subscriber to our weekday podcast and would like to listen to more of our content, where we regularly interview book authors, industry experts, and strategists from around the globe, go to Financial Sense and hit the subscribe button. On behalf of Financial Sense NewsHour and the Financial Sense Wealth Management team, we hope you have a pleasant weekend.
The Financial Sense NewsHour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the NewsHour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the Financial Sense staff and do not take into account listener suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense NewsHour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies mentioned in Financial Sense or arising out of the use of any material on the NewsHour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.